In taking up such a problem as marriage and divorce, it seems only fair that we speak not from the standpoint of theory, but from such practical experience or insight as has been gained from over 40 years of working with people who have, among other problems, marital difficulties. Therefore, we're going to restrain ourselves from theorizing and work with such elements as experience has shown to be true. Now, it is, of course, definite that our experience has been within a certain general area. Therefore, perhaps we have dealt, all in all, with a more thoughtful, more responsible group of people than would represent a general cross-section of the American public. At the same time, if the thoughtful have their troubles, it is obvious that those less thoughtful will be even more seriously afflicted. In the course of years, the general trend or tendency in marital difficulty seems to have shifted. Until today, I would suspect that the principal cause of trouble is a central and basic lack of self-discipline. Through the years, our thresholds of personal control have lowered markedly. Under the pressures of luxury living, with ever greater inducements to a rugged individuality, we are less inclined to be patient with other people, thoughtful of them, and less inclined to assume long responsibilities for which we see no definite advantages. Thus, in self-discipline, which begins in childhood and must continue through the years, we have the foundation of all enduring values. The individual who is self-disciplined is a better citizen, a better marital partner, a better businessman, better in his responsibilities to his friends and to all of the levels of the community in which he lives. The undisciplined person lacks the ability to direct his own efforts. He lacks the ability to place reasonable curbs upon his own conduct. He is unable to weather the various storms of pressure that arise. In fact, today, we are producing a generation of people much too soft, lacking in all forms of self-control, easily over-influenced, too quickly depressed, too easily disturbed. Now, this may seem to be an exaggeration when we realize how very serious problems can become, and that sometimes even the greatest measure of patience will not do very much to solve them. But where we have, as at the present time, a divorce rate that is too large for common sense and public good, the divorces annually in this country are gradually rising to close to 500,000 a year. When we realize also that a considerable number of our people are under religious obligations which will not sanction divorce or make remarriage almost impossible, we know that there are many others who, if it were not for these restraints, would also seek separations. As each of these divorces influences at least two persons, and in the many instances several children, we may safely say that divorce is now a tragic interlude in the lives of some 2 million of our people every year. This is a very heavy toll, much of which depends upon this factor of lack of self-discipline. Self-discipline should tell us all, very simply and quickly, that life is not easy, that things are not going to go well all the time, that we are going to be faced with situations that require thoughtfulness and patience and unselfishness and kindness and forgiveness. If we are deficient in the ability to administer these gentler phases of our character, we are certainly not going to survive the numerous shocks that flesh is heir to. We are going to find small difficulties magnified. We are going to develop into a neurotic over situations that 50 years ago no one would have paid any attention to. So we can go back and consider the problems when I was doing religious counseling as a minister in the 20s and 30s of this century. We found that the average person who had marital difficulty came to seek strength to carry it better. Now, in some cases, this may have been a futile attitude, and it was, no question about it. But these persons believe that the primary responsibility in marriage was to preserve the marriage. They wanted to do everything possible to them to help to understand, to overcome the weaknesses in themselves which might contribute to the breaking of a home. Most of these persons were willing to go far beyond halfway in their effort to keep the home together. They were willing to sacrifice a great part of their own individuality, their own freedom, even their own peace of mind, if as a result they could maintain a better and more purposeful family relationship. In the last 5 or 10 years, this attitude has markedly diminished. The individual today finds difficulties, pressures which he cannot face with the dignity. He finds the smallest flaws in other people unbearable. He has no time or consideration to consider his own contributions to the difficulties. He assumes that everyone should understand him and feels no responsibility to understand anyone else. He takes the attitude that a home is primarily a place in which everything should run well of its own accord, or as the result of a steering committee composed entirely of the other member of the family. He assumes, or she assumes, that things should go naturally well because the other persons involved went out of their way to make things as agreeable and comfortable as possible for the individual who is complaining. This attitude carries with it also a continual diminishing sense of responsibility for family as such. The Chinese philosopher Confucius pointed out that the strength of a nation lies in the unity of its homes. We used to feel that this simply meant that the broken home was a contemporary disaster in the generation in which it occurred. I think Confucius meant much more than this. It is from the insecurity of the home the children must come without the adequate foundations necessary to build homes for themselves later. Thus, the broken home is the beginning of a chain reaction that may endure or continue for several generations. All these chain reactions making it ever less likely that the homes of the future will be secure. We realize also that in various educational institutions where domestic problems have been considered as part of the educational program, there is a distinct improvement in marriage probabilities. those who have made in their school and college years a study of this subject, becoming at least generally aware of its facts and probabilities, these persons do better. It is therefore indicated that ignorance is no blessing in this department as in any other, and that things can be helped if individuals really want to help the situations to improve. In the last 15 years, the average American has become much more neurotic than in the past. He seemingly has not the stamina to resist discord. He finds it more and more difficult to keep his own temperament on an even keel. He finds arguments quicker to arise. He finds personal injuries or insults more difficult to forget. By degrees, he is becoming so supersensitive and hypersensitive that it is becoming difficult for him to live with anyone else and almost impossible for him to live with himself. Naturally, this type of condition gravitates against any form of permanent relationships between people. Another situation that seemingly has a bearing upon this is the tempo of our time in general. In the last generation, marriages endured because conditions remained very much the same. The individual could plan for many years in advance, and the probabilities were that these plans could be fulfilled. The person looked forward to a life very much like the life he was living at any given time or day. Today, these patterns of general support from society are also breaking down. The changes that are taking place in world conditions are reacting upon persons, injuring these persons' securities, taking from them all long-range programs, interfering with their hopes for thrift and saving, and burdening them with ever heavier responsibilities. The costs of living have also had a very serious effect upon domestic patterns, and one of the phases of this can be the education of children. We know today that it will cost as much to get the average boy or girl through college as the average man earned in a lifetime 100 years ago. It is going to cost more in the future. It's going to mean that to meet the levels and standards of living as we know them today, provide our families with the conveniences, necessities, and especially luxuries which they regard now as an essential birthright, the parents must have greater sense of responsibility, more instinct toward self-denial, more willingness to work for others and for times which they may not even live to see. These feelings are not of the moment, for the individual today wishes to spend what he earns as he pleases, and the sooner the better. Advertising, promotion, theater, drama, motion pictures, all these factors have added to the general insecurity. They have added to the personal ambitions of individuals. They have complicated normal relationships, and they have disturbed profoundly millions of persons who have no solid ground of their own on which to stand. The individual who is integrated in himself is not easily over-influenced. But where this integration is lacking, he can be constantly moved from his basic convictions and set adrift upon a sea of circumstances much too stormy for his ability to control. So in this problem, astrology can play an interesting part. Perhaps astrology in this particular instance is little more than a restatement of common sense. But it does tell us certain things that all persons should know, should understand, and should appreciate who expect to build lives with others or perpetuate some common institution which already exists. Without certain basic senses or feelings about these things, we cannot hope to achieve permanent security and permanent happiness. The home should be the one place in the world where values are secure. The individual with this personal security has much more probability of surviving the pressures of public life. Without some type of security, without some type of intimacy which is gentle, kindly, and understanding, it is very difficult to withstand the pressure of the world patterns under which we have to function. Astrology tells us, first of all, that every person is born with a character. He is born with a disposition, a temperament, a personality. And astrology does reveal, through long working with it, that the average person is not going to change his basic pattern. If he has certain deep-seated convictions within his own nature, certain policies, attitudes, certain dispositional intensities, these may be modified. These may be brought from a comparatively barbaric to a more civilized stage, but they will not be basically changed. Therefore, in all relationships with people, we have relationships with individuals whose individuality is just as important to them as ours is to ourselves. We are not creating relationships with images, with patterns, with thought forms, with projections of our own beliefs. We can invest other people with any type of characteristic we desire, but if that characteristic is not in them, this investiture will mean nothing. It will not result in any permanent, enduring value. So everyone starting out in life, in the home, in the family, in business, must gradually learn to realize that he is surrounded by persons, not masses. He is not an individual in the midst of a sea of mysterious universals. He is a person among persons. His friends are going to be persons. If he marries, he will marry a person. If he has children, they will be persons. If he has relatives, they will be persons. And when he goes into business, he will deal with persons. He will not deal with vast unknown potentials which can be anything he wants them to be. He is surrounded by unchanging values. He is surrounded by individuals whose ambitions, impulses, instincts, and appetites are as strong as his own or stronger. Thus, he is not in a world in which he can drift along and expect smooth sailing. He is in a world in which he must share, he must work with other people, he must give them the rights to their own ideas, he must defend his own principles, but he also must have the genius to discover when other people are more correct than he is, and he must have the willingness to adapt his own personal pleasures and prejudices to such facts as he may discover as he proceeds. Each person is born with a nature, is born with a degree of selfishness and unselfishness, a degree of self-control and a degree of lack of self-control. Each person has his own preferences in every area of life. He has his own beliefs. He has his own religious convictions, or lack of them. He has within this person, which seems so much like other persons from the outside, which may dress like other persons, may follow the general habits of other persons in public life, he has to face that within this person that seems to be just one of many, there is always a uniqueness of some kind. And this uniqueness must either be appreciated in relationships or it will become an impossible pressure. So from astrology, we learn that the common, everyday values of life can be mixed and commixed into an infinite diversity of patterns. That in these patterns, in the midst of them, as a spider within its web, is the individual who has created this intricate patternry of his own life by the pressures of his own nature, by the intensities of his emotions, and by the directions of his mind and will. Here he is established. And in most cases, this establishment among Western peoples is hopelessly self-centered. It is self-centered because the average person does not understand how it can be otherwise. It never occurs to him to become non-self-centered. His entire concept of success depends upon getting ahead. His concept of distinction leads to actions likely to advance the individuality of self. So self is frightfully important. Now in religion, in the older days, nearly all great philosophies and religious systems advocated the development of unselfishness. Some way it was recognized that this self could become excessive. And by humility, by humbleness, by detachment from the tremendous intensities of self, the individual gained a certain reward. The reward of being more adaptable, more adjustable, and more companionable with other people. If we take the horoscope of a person, we find that in this chart, there are certain indications. One of these indications may have to do with the vitality of that person. We begin to estimate how much energy supply this individual has. Is he going to spend his years in a very positive relationship with society? Or is it going to happen that after a while he is going to get very tired? And in this tiredness, give up perhaps not only many of his ambitions, but perhaps a number of his values. So we have to determine the degree of the life principle that is available to that person through his span here. What is his physical health situation going to be? Health has a tremendous effect upon mental and emotional attitudes. And attitudes, conversely, as we learn from psychosomatic medicine, attitudes have a tremendous effect upon health. So we have a person whose life expectancies, whose vitality expectancies are going to affect disposition. The next problem we may consider will be the imagination of this person, usually invested in the moon. If this person has an extremely powerful imagination, he may develop into a great creative thinker or a great creative artist. But if this imagination is afflicted by restrictions and limitations of faculties, if it is adversely related to other elements of character, this imagination may turn into one of the cruelest of all emotional problems, and that is suspicion. It may develop jealousies. It may cause this person to allow his emotional life to be led away into negative apprehensions of all kinds. Jealousy can and often does become a very dangerous factor in the life of the individual. It can cause the most dangerous and tragic consequences, and at least can lead to a long enduring neurotic reaction to daily experience. So imagination is very important. How has this imagination been trained? One of the ways we train imagination in our modern society is through disillusionment.
The individual perhaps had a reasonably well-organized imagination, but not much strength of will, has a series of unhappy experiences and becomes disillusioned. From that time on, his logical factors are impaired, and he begins to confer previous conditions upon future possibilities. He begins to consider negatively all things that can happen because of certain things that have happened. Another problem in imagination is that it loses all sense of realities. It causes an individual to look back upon a life that is far happier than the average and see nothing good in it. It causes a person to remember every misfortune he has ever experienced and completely forget the numerous happy and fortunate occurrences which he has enjoyed. Imagination, therefore, can turn an individual with only a reasonable burden of responsibilities into one who regards himself as the most afflicted of mortals and can see no reason why he should not feel that both heaven and nature are against him and have been from the beginning. In addition to imagination also, the study of the horoscope reveals the nature of the individual's basic integrities, largely through the positions of Saturn. These integrities are the honors or the values that will not change. These values perhaps will slightly disappear or have a tendency to be modified during the intense middle years of life. But the values with which the individual started, which came up through his early life, are the values almost certainly with which he will die. He will finally bring them back again to determine whether he is basically conscientious, basically honorable, basically reliable, whether he does have continuities of purpose, whether he is capable of powerful dedications to principles. These things are revealed through the basic structure of his chart. Also from this chart will come his judgments, as represented largely by the planet Jupiter. His judgments have to do with his probabilities of survival economically, industrially. Also, his judgments help him to build internal character. His judgments have much to do with his religion, with his basic philosophy of life. They tell us whether he is going to be a serious person or a superficial one. Also, they will tell us something of the philosophy of life that he is going to build himself through the years, whether he is going to end as an idealist or a materialist, whether he is going to become generous-minded or cynical, whether he is going to be an easy believer or a skeptic. All these things are indicated by the position of Jupiter and the various aspects which it forms. If Jupiter has certain afflictions, this individual's judgment will always be bad. It is often the case with Jupiter that we have powerful ambitions and poor judgment. We have the individual also choosing poorly the level of values to which he is going to dedicate his life. He may sacrifice the best part of himself for a psychology of success. He may sacrifice too much of health to worldly things, achieving them, finding himself too ill to enjoy them. Thus, Jupiter has to do with his broad philosophy of life, has to do with the values which he will gradually build and intensify through the years, and also to a measure whether he is going to be basically optimistic or basically pessimistic. Then also his drive, his power to achieve, his success in life, the continuance of his basic relationships with life have to do with Mars. Where Mars is strong, the libido is strong. Where Mars is powerfully placed and well-aspected, the individual has the enthusiasm, has the vitality, and has the power drive necessary to assure certain advantages for himself. If this Mars is not controlled, however, he develops belligerence, and belligerence will destroy nearly every sensitive relationship that he has. It is therefore very careful planning indeed, which will enable the individual with a powerful Mars to discover the difference between reasonable and unreasonable ambitions. It is hard for this powerful martial person to retire when the time comes and enjoy what he has. He puts off rest for the future, when in many cases his restlessness will never permit him to catch up to this future of peace that he longs for. Others take the attitude that they want to end this life in this harness of activity. They want to keep right on to the end, working, building, struggling, and if necessary, scheming a little. Mars, in any event, relates these more definite activities with which we are concerned. Venus bestows its beauty upon our lives. The powerful Venusian person is by nature an aesthete. He follows most naturally the love of beauty, of order, of graciousness, of formalities. He is given to surrounding himself with pleasant and gracious environments. He seeks the cultivation of personal appearance. He seeks to become more proficient in creative arts. He may be given to music, or to painting, or to sculpturing, or literature, or the dance, or any one of the many aesthetic branches of learning. Most of all, however, the positive Venusian, the one in whose chart Venus is strong and valuable, this person wants harmony. He is a peace lover and is willing, if necessary, to fight for peace. He wants it. He needs it. Nearly all of his discords and tensions arise from his struggle to achieve harmony. And sometimes he makes a pretty inharmonious situation of trying to get there. Also, because Venus rapidly deteriorates into luxury in an afflicted chart, we find the individual overly indulgent, overly concerned with the fulfillment of his appetites. We find him likewise too luxury-loving, leading to vast structures built upon wealth and authority. We find, therefore, that as one prominent Venusian said many years ago, man has six senses, the five we know and the sixth sense is money, and without that one you can't enjoy any of the other five. So this is a typical Venusian attitude, which accounts for the fact that under this sign, under the power of this planet, we have more creative artists, bankers, and stockbrokers than in any other sign. This combination of art and money seems to be strongly under the Venusian tendency. This leads in the intimate relationships of life perhaps to too much extravagance, too much pressure upon money, too much demand upon money for the gratification of sensory perception. This tendency is revealed in the various degrees of development which we find in connection with Venus. Now, in the case of Mercury, we have here the kind of planet that has to do with the essential compatibilities of people. If we have a good Mercury, we have an individual who in his relationship with people is a good sport. He is perhaps aware of the mistakes of others, but he's aware also of his own. The mercurial person who is well integrated has the capacity to overlook things. He has the capacity not to be deceived, but not to make issues where they are unnecessary. If, therefore, the Mercury person is a highly evolved type, he will have a strong intellectual life. He will be companionable on a mental level. He will be interested in interesting things. And he will be able to discuss, debate, and argue without too much bitterness. If, on the other hand, the mercurial person is not so well integrated, he is apt to become extremely fussy, picayunish in his attitudes. He is apt to make too much of details. He is going to be too demanding and react too quickly to small things, hypersensitive to defects that other persons would not even notice. He is also, in a negative sense, likely to become too demanding upon other people for small actions, small indications of behavior. He is going to become too word conscious. He is not going to give other people the benefit of a doubt. He is going to take everything they say too literally and become hypocritical. We have already suggested the relation of the moon to the imagination, so we have left three other factors we have to consider. It is not common to find today a person who is truly and completely under the influence of Uranus. The true Uranian type we usually consider to be the highly eccentric person. Generally speaking, unless Uranus is very well aspect, very highly evolved, it has little to contribute to human relationships. It is always going to represent an unusual or exceptional situation. It is going to break patterns. It's going to be difficult to live with because the people in whom it is strong are unpredictable. They are inconsistent. They are given suddenly to causes and then get over these causes equally suddenly. They are naturally humanitarian, and this is one of the heaviest burdens that flesh must bear, because these people are always trying to help someone. And when they get through helping them, the person is really in trouble. The well-intentioned type of Uranus is not very valuable unless it is well-disciplined, well-organized, highly cultivated, deeply informed. And even under the best of conditions, most Uranian persons leave behind them when they go a quantity of unfinished business. Some of our Uranian presidents have left behind a century of discord, which others have been unable to solve. The Uranian person is therefore an individual of tremendous intensities, tremendous imagination, usually of loyal and self-sacrificing nature, but inclined to go off on tangents which are difficult for other people under other signs to meet with quietude and peace of mind. So the Uranian person is an eccentric, and in marriage they almost have to be married to another eccentric or things go badly. They are very hard for conservative people to get along with. The Neptunian individual is of quite a different nature, also rather seldom met, because the Neptunian becomes so deeply subjective in his life that he gains not necessarily a complete self-security, but develops gradually the tendency, at least, to retire into his own depths whenever problems arise. Neptune, therefore, makes these silent sufferers that are a great cause of discord to people who like to be more articulate. It is very hard sometimes to get along with the person who won't talk back, who will not get angry himself, who will not do the very things that we do, because if he has better control than we have, he makes us a little ashamed of ourselves, and then we really hate him. It's very hard to work with these people because we can't get at them. They are very isolated in their ways of life, and your strong Neptunian often goes into religious orders, often departs from general worldly situations, and takes on a strangely detached existence. If he is particularly well integrated, he may go strongly into mysticism and higher idealism, and will become a very patient, thoughtful, but somewhat detached and somewhat forgetful individual in matters of worldly relationships. But if he is afflicted or has a Neptune that is not well placed, he is a person who has mysterious, deep pressures which he cannot control and which flow out from him to create confusion and discord around him if he's not very careful. The Pluto person we know very little about up to the present time, but we suspect rather strongly that he is, again, more or less of this secretive type, that he has to do with deeper inner pressures of personality. that his life is strangely affected from early childhood. Most Pluto persons in whom this planet is very powerful seemingly have been markedly changed by sudden events in early life. They are the persons who carry, perhaps more than any other group, the tremendous stamp of a favorable or an unfavorable environment as they grew up. They are almost perfect examples of what the psychologist calls the product of environmental pressure. Thus, these people have been molded or moved often contrary to their original natures, and this in turn leads to conflict for which perhaps there is no obvious explanation. So if you take these separate elements now, and then you combine all of them into a still larger compound, it is obvious to any thoughtful individual that a person, and every person must have all these factors within his personality, that each person is a very complex structure, that he is one we cannot expect to solve easily, nor can we expect this person to follow in any general direction. 200 or 300 years ago, the institution of marriage functioned very largely on a military basis. The typical German home of the early 19th century had father as general, mother as captain, and the children were all private soldiers in the rear rank. There was perhaps one top sergeant, the eldest son, who was being groomed for high office. If anything happened to father, mother automatically became general and was never lacking in generalship. She was quite able to take over the situation. It gave her the opportunity to extrovert that she may have waited for 30 years, and she did a pretty good job of it. This tendency, however, to the regimentation of families resulted, of course, in an outward serenity which often covered a concealed disorder. Most of these very well-regimented homes were not essentially successful homes. They were more successful in a time when they were generally accepted, because we have always been servants of style. We have always wanted to be what other people were. And when everyone was regimented, we thought to be regimented the same way. This tendency, however, has gradually changed. And today, the regimented home is a highly debatable issue. It is doubtful if it even exists as we used to know it, unless it may be in less advanced social groups. But today, the home is not regimented. In fact, it has gone so far off the deep end of lack of organization that its condition is perilous and its boundaries completely indefinite. There seems to be no way of bringing it into the old arrangements that we once knew. Yet it must have some arrangement, because today it is losing practically all of its purposes and functions. It is no longer contributing to anything. It is no longer even an economy. Things have so changed that we have to begin to reevaluate some of the patterns of home relationships. Everything exists for a reason. Nature, in its infinite wisdom, did not create human relationships merely from some arbitrary whim. Human relationships exist for one purpose psychologically and one purpose biologically. Biologically, the purpose is the perpetuation of the species, and to this end, nature has conspired in every form of life since the beginning of time. Psychologically, the purpose of the family or the home is education. Psychologically, we are brought together in order that we may learn to advance common destinies. We are brought together in order that we may complement deficiencies in our own natures. We are brought together in order that we may develop certain virtues and unfold certain richness of psychological overtone within ourselves. The final end of marriage for each person is that that person himself grows through common relationships with other persons. The sacrifice that the individual makes to maintain a home is a form of growth for that individual. It is a symbol of gradually developing maturity. The individual who accepts no responsibility, desires no responsibility, and if he is forced into it, resents it to the end, this individual is a perpetual adolescent. The individual who wishes only to do as he pleases is the child mind, or at least we may say is extremely childish.